Soundtrack to Free Fire, that's the Free Firing Gunshot Solo, which gives you a fair indication of what our good friend Ben Wheatley's new movie is all about. Deliberately avoiding convoluted plotting, the narrative does hinge on a telephone and an awful lot of shooting. I'm Edith Bowman and you're listening to Soundtracking, a podcast in which we explore the relationship between music and the screen. Ben, of course, was our first ever guest on this show, and it's an absolute pleasure to welcome him back to discuss Free Fire, a super stylish action comedy which he co-wrote with his wife and longtime creative partner, Amy Jump. Now, the film scored by Jeff Barrow and Ben Salisbury, who took sonic inspiration from David Shire's experimental jazz funk suite for the taking of Pelham 123. Excuse, as if any were needed, to play you some of it. This is nice because you were our first ever podcast.
Yes.
So thank you.
That's right.
For doing that one. Thanks for coming back. I can't remember where you were with Free Fire when we talked last, but we couldn't really talk about it.
It was probably shot and edited. It just took a long time because of the festival process to come out.
The music in it's brilliant. It's a relationship that was built working on High Rise with Jeff and Ben. You've said already, you know, the music started for Free Fire whilst you were still making High Rise with those two.
Yeah, it was the conversations that we were having backwards and forth. And it started with David Shire, really, with the soundtrack for the taking of Pelham 123. And Pelham 123 is quite interesting because I always assumed that the soundtrack for that was really long, like a contemporary movie, which is just larded with music from end to end.
Yeah.
And so I bought it, you know, which is a rare thing because I couldn't find it anywhere. I bought it and it cost me like 35 quid. It was a stinger on a CD as well.
Yeah. Wow, that's really, I mean, yeah, I was thinking rare. Vinyl there, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it's
wow.
Quite rare. I'm sure that people can find it for 2p, but I couldn't anyway. Bought this thing and it was like it's 12 minutes long, that album. There's hardly any music on the Taken Pelham 123. I was really surprised, you know, both from being kind of a mean person and having spent quite a lot of money on an album that was only
£3 a minute.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a good maths. Yeah, it's like a basically like a 12 inch that I'd bought. Anyway, which got me thinking, you know, it's kind of interesting that there's hardly any music on it. And a lot of movies around that period in the 70s didn't have tons of music necessarily or tons of score.
They also repeated quite a lot of stuff, didn't they?
Yeah, they'd have a theme that they'd go back to. But even in Pelham 123, when you watch it, it's got a little bit of music at the beginning, a tiny bit of music in the middle, and then a bit at the end, you know. So we approached the film in a very different way, you know, Amy and I, because we didn't want to put temp music on it. I know we had a long conversation about temp music before. And by the way, I really listened to that podcast and I'm talking incredibly quickly in that. Shocking.
I didn't really notice. What I did notice was all the sirens and the buses in the background, because we did it at the Picture Central House, but I don't remember. Maybe we sped it up slightly.
Right, right. Run out just of time, don't we? Going on too much. Yeah, because I thought I'm inhumanly fast. Anyway, so we didn't use any temp music in the film, and it was the first time we'd ever done that, cut a film with no music, because every time we put music over it, it made it weird and different, and we gathered a load of thrillery music and 70s-y music and David Shire music and all this stuff. But whenever we put it on, it just made the film seem lame, you know, and like the other films and not like itself. So we decided to cut it silent. You know, I think I've read that like a lot of editors kind of swear by that you shouldn't really put temp on, because it basically props the movie up where it might not necessarily deserve to.
Yeah.
And your generous use of the Harry Potter soundtrack across your whole film was adding a layer of sweetness that maybe it didn't deserve or something, you know. So we showed it to Ben and Jeff and went, look, here, where do you think the music should go?
Oh, wow.
Rather than, here's a load of very famous music, please replace it. And that made for a kind of approach where they didn't write that much music, so the score's quite short for the film. But where it comes in, it really, really counts. Ben and Jeff had this idea, which was that all the music is going to be like source music and found music, even their score. And that they had this kind of, they've spun me this fantasy that I'd walked into a record shop and I bought this kind of weird prog rock garage band album, and I'd taken it home and I put it on my record player and plugged it into the edit and it fitted the film, and then I used that album. I was like, right, okay, how's that work then? He goes, well, we're going to go and write that album now. So it was kind of conceptual.
Wow.
It was quite interesting. Yeah. So they recorded it with quite a lot of the musicians from Beak on it.
Yeah.
And they created a kind of free fire band. So something like High Rises, Clint Mansell would go and write the temp, and that would be on synth, and then it would get arranged, and then we would record it with the orchestra, and then we'd have all those different stems of violins and oboes and whatever. And you can change around in the mix, and then you might want to choose one bit or another. But with this, it was just like a big slab of music which you couldn't unpick, and that was it. And we just laid it on top of the film, and away you go. And the other one that they had was, the idea that they had was that they wanted to make music that was period, but they also didn't want to make it pastiche. So they looked at the composers around the time, like Shire, David Shire and Lalo Schifrin and all these guys, and tried to work out what it was that made them from that period. It's not wah-wah pedals or even particular instruments. What it is their background, and their background is usually from jazz and free jazz. and they're guys who've gone through telly, certainly Schifrin did, and then had to make loads and loads of music for cop shows. And it's like kind of their day job. At night, they're all out blowing saxophones in clubs. But during the day, they're writing guitar-based stuff for cop shows. Schifrin kind of moves up the ladder, ends up doing things like Bullet and Dirty Harry. Thing that makes them unique is that the crazy jazzness makes them very bold in terms of what instruments they use and what rhythms they use and stuff, in a way that someone who'd just come up through a band might not be. So that's what Ben and Jeff brought to the soundtrack. They just went, we're going to make it mental, you know.
Much film scoring work before?
Yeah, well, I'd first come across them on a record called Drock, D-R-O-K-K, which is well worth checking out. And Drock is a swear word in 2000 AD. It's what Judge Dredd says a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a made-up swear word that kids can
like
read in a newspaper without getting in trouble.
Trouble, yeah.
They'd written the soundtrack for Dredd, and there were some shenanigans and it didn't get used, but it's phenomenal, absolutely brilliant.
We'll be right back.
I'd kind of got that first, and then they did the soundtrack for Ex Machina.
Yeah.
And they were the two scores they did. And I think Ben had done stuff for... He had a whole career writing stuff for natural history documentaries and that side, and then teamed up with Jeff to do Drock. The Ex Machina soundtrack is very kind of minimalist stuff, and Free Fire is very, very different from that.
There was a couple of songs that you were going to use to open Free Fire, but they were almost like too literal.
Yes.
In terms of, oh, it's great, but the title of the track's kind of almost too much.
Yeah, well, I had a really big playlist of tracks, and I was trying to find grungier and grungier stuff. I ended up with The Real Kids Do The Boob through just searching Boston. 1977, I think it was, and it came up with a massive load of stuff, and I found this track and I listened to it and I went, well, it's something really sleazy and nasty. And as the drums coming in, because I've seen the beginning of the film a lot doing the Q&A's, drumming's really bad.
That's kind of good.
Yeah, it kind of goes out of time, like the third hit goes. When I was driving around Boston looking for players just to shake my Boob is just appalling, you know, and I'm going around town wanting to, why is the music so rubbish? It should be like it used to be. Like, what? They want it to be more like rock and roll, and yet they're playing this odd mishmash of punk and new wave and slightly uncool end of the street that's not happening at CBGB's, isn't it, you know? So that really coloured the whole process. And then when I played it to Jeff and Ben, they were like, oh, this is really sleazy. This is nasty. This is harrowing, this music. It's just grim.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. And they basically changed the whole soundtrack around that. Because before, we had a bit more of a heavy, harping, steel, brass, David Shire stuff.
Yeah.
And they just scrapped that straight away and said no. Jeff said... the music has got to be as stupid as the characters. That was his thought. I was like, oh, thanks, Jeff, that's great.
I think.
But I'd listened to other stuff, like I found a cover of Hanging on the Telephone, and I thought that was, and I always thought it was a Blondie track, and it's like, and it's not. The cover of Hanging on the Telephone is by The Nerves, and that sounds it's a bit Beatlesy, but then it's also heading towards the Ramones as well, you know. It's got that vibe to it that it could go either way, you know, at that point. And I like that kind of moment where, you know, it's 70, the film never says when it's set, but it's kind of like 77 78, but it's punk and disco and everything happening at the same time, you know.
Yeah,
quite like.
I'm in the phone booth, there's the one across the hall.
got a John Denver story for you.
And the John Denver, which, you know, is part of the narrative of the film, was that always going to be the case?
Yeah, it was written into it from the very first draft. And it had come from the first image I'd had for the movie, which is of a man in a van driving in a circle in a warehouse or some kind of covered area, and he's bleeding to death, and what would be the worst song to listen to while you were doing this? And he's like lying on he's lying on the seat going, oh, I'm really in agony, but I don't really enjoy this track. I really should turn it off. I've only got a certain amount of energy. I could save myself, or I could just turn this track off.
You fill up my senses like a night in a forest, like the mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me again.
I love the track, you know, the track's a track I heard when I was a kid, and it's a beautiful track. It's a really well-written track as well, from my humble opinion.
I think we may well see John Denver re-entering the charts after
the charts,
this as well,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
I think people are going to go out and go, God, John Denver, Ben Wheatley's got him in his film, he's cool, let's listen to him. Definitely.
I hope so.
You me
know.
Too.
Let me give my life to you.
Frankie Goes to Hollywood track at the end of Sightseers went to number one the Christmas after Sightseers came out, because of Sightseers, because it went around the advertising world and they saw it and then they put it on the John Lewis ad. So I remember sitting in a cafe and it coming on and said, number one, it's the cover of Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and I was like eating a sandwich going, I think I might have made that happen. Maybe.
I watched High Rise again, and it's really interesting when you watch films three or four times, but there was a couple of moments that just really kind of resonated with me. One was the scene where it's all kind of starting to go doolally, and it goes from the supermarket with the pulsating techno into the dangerous liaison party upstairs with the string version of SOS, and it's seamless. It's amazing. It's almost like the elevator doors close and open and the music does the same.
That's the bit that has the really harsh cutting as well, isn't it? The lights are going on and off. And I remember, when we were in Toronto and some guys came up to me and said, look, they'd seen the film, and the audience were shouting at the screen at that bit going, the film is broken! Apparently, because they couldn't take the editing.
No.
And I was so chuffed. I was like, yeah, it is broken. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
It's broken.
Can we talk a little bit more about Clint on that film? I remember coming to see him do his live show at the Royal Festival Hall when you introduced him.
Yeah.
And, you know, you both kind of told the story about he wasn't able to do the film at a certain point, but you wanted to wait for him because he was the right man for that job.
Yeah. poor Clint had had this tragedy, but he didn't want to just bow out of the job. He wanted to talk it through, like a kind of to have closure kind of thing on it. And I went to see him, and I was excited just to see him. I was sad that he was in under those circumstances. It was appalling. So we had a drink and kind of a chat, and it just came out of that, really. And he's got two incredibly large, hollow legs and can drink for Britain. So he completely destroyed me at this bar. And then at the end, it was like, oh, and then we kind of agreed to do it. You know, I was like, all right, well, wait, it's fine, Clint, don't worry about it. And he's like, oh, I will do it then, right at the end of it. So I was like, oh, and then I woke up the next morning going, oh my God, oh, what's happened? You know, I had to go to a kind of a quiet place and drink water for about 6 months to recover from it. Of course, we'd wait for him. Why not? You know, it's like, you know, his stuff's brilliant. For me, Moon is about as close as you get to a perfect soundtrack.
Yeah.
I've got it on my phone, you know, and so occasionally it comes up and I go, oh, it's Moon, great.
Yeah,
you know, and
it's like a good friend, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so brilliant. How I'd wanted to do it, because you know, you want to get people in really early to combat this whole dull world of the temp. So we did. Amy and I broke all our own rules and stuck temp all over it, and then we had the problems that we knew were going to happen. You know, but it was fine. You know, it's kind of it was worth it for working with Clint. I don't know what I expected, but I didn't expect that he'd be, you know, so open and easy to work with. You know, because I kind of play the same game sometimes, that of this the game of being inclusive when you're in totally in control, you know, with work. But I know he plays it very, very well, you know. So I'm sitting there kind of going, I'm in the music making process when I'm completely not.
Yeah,
you
know?
But it's great. You know, maybe a tambourine here. Yes, there'll be a tambourine there. You know.
Cowbell on the next one.
Oh, yeah,
Talk a little bit about Amy and you guys working together and how much the two of you kind of discuss music. And is it around you whilst you're working together, writing the script?
I'm the one who listens to a lot of music, and Ames has got her own world of music that she has in the car, which is separate from mine, which does include quite a lot of Elbow albums and, weirdly, Julian Casablancas
solo projects
and stuff. Yeah. So I don't have anything to do with this. So I come and, you know, these discs turn up from Amazon and then disappear off to the car because I don't drive. So she drives around in the Volvo from Sightseers.
Yes!
Which we've got. And what I really like about that car is that it got dinged, so one of the doors had to be changed, and we said to the mechanics, we don't want a door that matches, we want one that's wrong.
Brilliant.
So that everyone knows when they're near it that this is a car that's dangerous, you know, that doesn't care. She's quite sensitive to music. You know, she needs quiet while she's writing, so she doesn't have anything on. Her listening world is in the car and on headphones when she's walking the dog, but not in the house that much. So I tend to like have the radio on, playing some music, and then when she comes in, I turn it off. So that's that. And then in writing, I don't tend to listen to anything with lyrics when I'm writing because mm-hmm. it's too distracting. And I found that I've been listening to the soundtrack from Lord of the Rings quite a lot.
Wicked.
Because it's a bit rousing, and you're often climbing up a mountain to drop a ring into a lava pit. That is what I feel like when I'm writing quite a lot.
The next film then is Freak Shift. I'm assuming you've got a big playlist for that.
Yeah, well, it's massive. You know, it's been on the cards since 2012. So a very old playlist for Freak Shift. And the playlist for Freak Shift is currently girl bands, mainly. Oh. From the 50s all the way through to Maya, M.I.A.
Yeah.
Which one is it?
M.I.A.
M.I.A, yeah, okay. And and Beyoncé and all that.
Please say Lordy.
Lordy. I like Beyonce, you know. And what's it? La Tigra, the punk end of the street, and yeah. American punk and UK punk, you know, and then Leader of the Pack and the Shangri-Las and all that yeah. kind of stuff. So it's a big old of women's voices.
He's sort of small. He kissed me goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. Whether he heard, I'll never know.
Look out, look out, look out, look out!
I felt so helpless, what could I do? Remembering all the things we've been
guys do consistently through the films is the females, they're just written so brilliantly and they're strong characters.
I think the films aren't made from a male perspective or a female perspective, they're made from a couple's perspective, you know, as much as possible.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important, you know. It's funny, I mean, I got cornered by someone the other day in the team, Free Fire, and they go, oh, it's very male. I'm like, well, it's written by a woman. And they're like, oh, damn, is it? Damn. Damn it!
thanks for coming back to chat to us, Ben, and congratulations on Free Fire. It's bloody awesome.
Well, congrats on your podcast, because it's great, and what a load of amazing people. You must have loads of negatives of them doing really terrible things to get them all those amazing people in.
I'm not going to say anything on that one.
War, thought it was a nightmare. Lawyers are so true. It told me don't go walking slow. Devil's on the loose. Better run through the jungle. Better run through the jungle. Better run through the jungle. Whoa, don't look back. But I heard a rumbling calling to my name. 200 million guns are loaded. Satan cried.
From the soundtrack to Free Fire, that's Run Through the Jungle by Creedence Clearwater Revival. Rounding off part two of my conversation with Ben Wheatley. Huge thanks to Ben for taking time out to chat to us again. He really does offer a fresh insight into his films. Free Fire is on general release now with Jeff Barrow and Ben Salisbury's score, available via our good friends at Lakeshore Records. Check out the first instalment of my conversation with Ben by heading to edithbowman.com, which features plenty more about the music in Kill List, Sightseers and Field in England, as well as Clint Mansell's work on High Rise. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And do rate us on iTunes if you get a moment. We're taking a week off for Easter to eat copious amounts of chocolate, so we'll see you back here in a fortnight. And I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.